So I guess I haven't been here since Sunday, since my son was born. And to tell you that a week ago Friday, my wife gave birth here in Redwood City, Kaiser. And we have a beautiful little boy who's was born at 7 pounds, 12 ounces, and promptly lost that weight, some of it. I don't know if he's back up to it yet, but looks very healthy and doing very well. And seems that the nights are not too bad. Seemingly each night is better. And so what else could you ask for? So it's very nice at home.
What's his name?
Oh, his name is Kai, K-A-I. So, in thinking about coming here today to give a talk, it occurred to me that I really have nothing on my mind to talk about. So I started thinking about that and thinking I'd about that. So I don't know if I just jinxed myself, you know, because maybe coming with nothing in my mind would have been perfect. And now I have nothing on my mind. A lot of thoughts about nothing. So I could talk about nothing for a while, and I certainly have some thoughts about it now. And I'm reminded that Suzuki Roshi, in his book, Zen My Beginner's Mind, he has a chapter called Believing in Nothing. And he starts off the chapter saying something like, it's very important to believe in nothing. So I could talk about nothing for a while, or it might be nice if we could just take questions for a while. And it's been a long time since we've had kind of questions and answer session. And if there are things that you've been waiting to say or ask for a long time, this could be a good time for that. So maybe we can do that, see if there's any questions. And if someone happens to ask about nothing, then I'll take off from there.
And what I'm finding is I have so much of something on my mind. In my mind, I'm going through, you probably talked about this in the class, but I'm going through all the, what I remember on the checklist in my mind through the sitting. And I was wondering if that's probably not the most skillful way to go about it. I feel so preoccupied with paying attention to how clear I am, how alert I am, and how much effort I'm making, and what the hindrances are. And so I feel busier, and maybe that's okay. I don't know. What do you think?
I think that one of the topics I've been thinking about talking about as a one of these days is the Buddhist teachings of skillful means. And one of the really important ideas in early Buddhism and Mahayana Buddhism is the idea of skill and means, skillful means, which implies that there's no fixed way of practicing, but rather you look at your particular condition and you look at the purpose for which you want to practice. If you want to become more peaceful or become more liberated or more compassionate or whatever, you know, the purpose, the goal of your, you think is important for yourself. And then what is most skillful, what's most helpful for that purpose. So I could well imagine that certain practices initially could be not so skillful because in a person's conditioned mind is one to be very self-conscious, very anxious. Maybe they bring with them all kinds of tendencies to be quick to judge and quick to kind of analyze and figure out, and you know, and so it's not so skillful to have a whole list of things to track, because it just makes the mind more tight. And so, Part of practice then is to notice the consequences and notice, oh, this is not so skillful. What is skillful for me in my particular condition? So maybe for you, the condition where would be skillful is, if you wanted to do the homework, is put out of your mind completely that list of things to track until you're finished the sitting. And then, with the best of your recall, go through the list and kind of remember what happened. And don't worry about even how well you do, how well you remember. And just, you know, do the best you can. So the issue is, well, how can you do the homework that's most skillful for the condition of your particular mind? What's also skillful might be to use something like that kind of exercise to see what your own tendencies are and see, oh, whenever I'm giving kind of instructions like this, I get really busy and tight. Why is it that happens for me? As opposed to saying, well, forget that. I'm going to go back to some very simple kind of thing and just go back to emptiness or to just letting go and being peaceful. If you make kind of a rash judgment to let go of something that's useful, maybe it's not so helpful for you in the long term. Some practices are kind of like riding a bicycle. If you first learn trying to learn to ride a bicycle, it's awkward. And as soon as if you give up the first time it's awkward on a bicycle, then you know you'll never learn to ride a bicycle. But if you hang in there with a while, after a while it becomes second nature and quite easy. And my hope is. My hope in giving the instructions is that in its classic form, mindfulness practice involves paying attention to the object of awareness. So if you feel the breath, pay attention to the breath very carefully. And it's very helpful to do that. When body sensations arise, they're quite compelling, you pay attention to those sensations, the object of awareness. If thoughts arise, you pay attention to the thoughts. If sounds arise, you pay attention to the sounds. If feelings arise, you pay attention to the feelings. And so there's a whole, you know, wide array of human experience we pay attention to. And sometimes when people do that, they ignore the fact that, they ignore kind of the quality of that mind which is paying attention. The quality of the practice itself. It's kind of like the stage director, stage director, which is kind of directing the show of the practice. Oh, now I pay attention to the breath and I'll stay there and that's useful. Now my knee hurts, it's burning, and it's okay, I'll bring my attention there and feel that and hold my attention there. That stage director is kind of off the stage. And part of what we're doing in mindfulness practice is to have nothing off stage, to have everything on stage. And so part of one of the things we pay attention to is the quality of the mind which is doing the practice. And when we do that, we find that the quality of that mind has a lot of different aspects to it. And one of the aspects, and so that list of things to track is some of the qualities of that mind or the quality of that inner ecology that comes into play when the mind is established and directed towards the breath or whatever. So say something as simple as paying attention to the breath. While you're with the breath, there needs to be some motivation to be with the breath. And that the degree of motivation can vary. You can sit down and say, oh, it's a good idea to be with my breath, and I think I should do that, you know, but I'll try. Or you can really be motivated. Say, yes, this is what I'm going to do. I'm really gung ho, and this is really serious. And I saw just in my own practice. I did the homework too. That it varied quite dramatically from one day to the next. Partly because the second day I did it at the end of the day, but for other reasons also, I was kind of weary and the motivation just wasn't there. I put a thing 2 for motivation, whereas the day before I think I had 7, you know, because I was really pretty intent, and I just couldn't muster more motivation. But it was interesting to track that, to notice that, oh, the motivation is varied. Sense of effort varies. Same practice, paying attention to the breath. Same practice, being with the breath, but the sense of faith. Or the sense of enjoyment, the sense of being connected to the body, the sense of being concentrated can vary to some degree. And so part of what we can do in practice is to actually be aware of these qualities of this mind, what's going on. It's just like paying attention to the breath or the sounds or the sunset, or it's just other things in nature that are happening. In nature, what's happening is the mind has faith or it has motivation or has... These things are happening anyway. And so part of what we're doing in the instructions of mindfulness practice is opening up the field of awareness so you can be more inclusive and have more things on the stage. It isn't so much to become busy. But initially it might seem like you're busy because you're beginning to track something you didn't weren't aware of before. But after a while it becomes second nature. Also, as you track these things, you're very much engaged in the present moment. And what some people might find is it might feel like they're doing a lot of things. But actually the mind can get very still doing a lot of things. Maybe you've done some kind of activity, I don't know what. Sometimes maybe you're reading a book or maybe some baking a cake or doing something. You have a hobby or something, or you do some kind of activity that really puts you right there in that activity. And there might be a lot of mental activity involved. You're kind of focusing how to do this and wondering how it's done. And like the other, like last week, we discovered that the plumbing under the sink in the kitchen was leaking. And then, because we have this new house, and whoever put in the plumbing put in this really awful kind of plastic pipes that all you have to kind of push on it turns out, and the whole thing kind of falls apart. It's kind of screwed in place. It's supposed to lock itself into place. And there's like five or six joints under there, and five or six of these joints are just kind of... So I tried to figure out how to make it work. It was this amazing puzzle to try to get all those different pieces lined up just right so that it wouldn't leak. I don't think plumbing should be this way, but... And once I finally got it, but then no one can breathe on those pipes. But I was kind of really into that, trying to figure out. My mind was very active in thinking and engaged, and it wasn't like my mind was... But everything else fell away, all my other concerns and, ideas of future and past and everything. And the mind got... I got very much into it and felt very harmonious and peaceful and happy. So there's a way of meditating where you can be very engaged in all that goes on. And that doesn't have to exclude the possibility of becoming very peaceful and still. But you're very engaged in the present moment, and all the concerns of past and future fall away. And perhaps all the concerns of self. You can be tracking, all these things, and you're not relating it to me, myself, and mine. And so it's possible to get really engaged in a wonderful way. Just be there, kind of riding the present moment, engaged and exploring. So now I worry that I've said so much that you've all gotten think there's so much to do again. Is this helpful, you think?
Yeah, it is.
There's two ways of understanding mindfulness instructions. There's many ways, perhaps, but two ways I'd like to say now. One is that the instructions in Vipassana practice can be seen as prescriptive, where you're being told what you're supposed to do. Now pay attention to the breath, now pay attention to the body, now pay attention to your feelings, now pay attention to this and that and this and that. And then you have to kind of figure out, when you're supposed to pay attention to, when different things are paying to be paid attention to. The other way to understand Vipassana practice, which is more the way it's practiced when practice becomes really mature and in its own good time, you don't have to be ahead of yourself. Like riding a bicycle, right? When you really know how to ride a bicycle, you can take your hands off the handlebar and just do fine. But you don't want to be ahead of yourself. You don't want to try to do that before you're ready. When the practice is mature in Vipassana, the instructions actually is understood more as being descriptive rather than prescriptive. And descriptive means that instructions just simply describing what you'd be aware of if your awareness is open to the present moment. If you're really open to the present moment, then you hear the sound of the traffic just now. You don't have to be told, pay attention to the traffic. It just, that's what arises. If you just sit quietly now with awareness open in the present, you become aware of different things. Traffic. Maybe sensations of your body, if some of you are uncomfortable sitting here for a while. Maybe your thoughts. What in the world is Gil talking about? You can become aware of that. Thoughts arise. You become aware of certain feelings. Maybe you're hungry. Or maybe you're wondering, why did I eat so many pancakes for breakfast before coming to sit or whatever? So there's things that arise in awareness. And what the mindfulness instruction is trying to do is to help you open the doors of awareness so that it's all inclusive. Not so that you get busy, but simply so that nothing's outside, and the practice then becomes descriptive of all these things that arises. And that's what was very helpful for me when I learned mindfulness practice, was I'd already had a long background in practice, but I hadn't really learned so well how to... I learned the theory, the idea that I was supposed to be inclusive, open to everything. But until my teachers kind of pointed to the various things that I wasn't paying attention to, I just didn't, you know, I didn't notice them. Or just, for example, I didn't notice very well or hardly when I got angry. The whole area of my emotions, you know, I was kind of open, but, you know, there was kind of like a blinders on. And then the teachers of the practice said, oh, pay attention to that, to emotions. And one of the things to pay attention to is the quality of the mind which is doing the practice, which is very helpful. Because if you're brand new to meditation, you don't want to track all these things. So that's why it's an intermediate course. And I shouldn't have been saying so much now to all these people. Some of you might be new. But sooner or later, if you practice for some time, you want to also track the quality of your practice itself. The quality of the mind which is paying attention to the breath, for example. Is it tight? Is it complacent? Is it anxious? Is it pushing to get something, some kind of make something happen? Is there a little bit tinge of aversion or hesitation in the mind? Is it, what's the quality of that mind? Because there's a lot of different qualities that come into play or associated with the factor of awareness itself. It's kind of like the team up with awareness. Am I making some sense? Hopefully it's helpful. Yes?
The item on the list that says strength of preoccupation.
Degree? I think it's supposed to say, you know, my spelling is not always so good. but degree of preoccupation. Oh, strength of preoccupation. Strength of preoccupation. So you're thinking. Preoccupation usually has to do with thoughts. So you're preoccupied with some kind of thing, some kind of thoughts, some kind of... And so how strong is that? And that's paired on the list with the ability to let go. How preoccupied are you with your, you know, on April 14th, you're probably very preoccupied with your taxes. And you can't let go of it. You let go of it for a moment and thoughts come right back. So you put a 10, you know, you're really caught up by those thoughts. But come, you know, you've paid your taxes and it comes to be April 30th, how preoccupied are your taxes? You know, maybe zero then. Haven't thought about it for a couple of weeks. So the degree of preoccupation. So sometimes when you sit, you find yourself actually very preoccupied by something. And it's just nice to notice that. Oh, I'm really preoccupied. This is a human being, or this is nature. This is the whole universe, 5 billion years of evolution, or whatever, of human, you know, world, whatever, has come to a human mind having this quality of preoccupation. Isn't this phenomenal? Wow. And, you know, isn't this amazing? As opposed to, wow, you know, I'm supposed to be a meditator. I meditated for a long time, and I'm so preoccupied, I can't do this, and this is terrible, and I just, you know, well, you know, maybe I should go out and, you know, go for a jog or a shower or try meditating next month when the taxes, whatever, you know. You know, you could do that, of course. Or you can just go, wow, 5 billion years of... And there's this thing, nature makes this thing, has come together at this particular junction in time and history, and all of history has conspired and made it possible for me to sit down here and be preoccupied about pizza. Wow. You know, it's like, you know, you look at a sunset and you're like in awe. You look at an oak tree that has this beauty, you're in awe of what, you know. Can you be in awe of your own mind that's thinking about whatever? So anyway, and then you can be in awe of the degree of preoccupation. Wow, it's like a volcano in there. Nature's capable of that. So strength of preoccupation. And sometimes you might not be at all preoccupied by anything, and it's, you know, the thoughts come. But there's no real Velcro, no real attachment there. And so, you know, it's pretty easy to let go and go back to the breath and just stay concentrating. The wow perspective. Yes?
Do you in this meditation occasionally take a thought and meditate upon it, reflect upon it? Like, say, loving kindness, compassion, anything like that. Do you do that? I mean, this meditation, I don't know. I remember someone mentioning it here, but in all the practices, I always think of naming it and knowing it and being with it. But do you do that in this type of meditation?
In Vipassana meditation, Vipassana meditation itself, insight meditation generally, is understood to be non-discursive. So they wouldn't be picking up a particular theme and then reflecting on it or letting it kind of digest or kind of reflect on it in some way, contemplate in some way, because that'd be somewhat discursive and reflective. And mindfulness practice is non-discursive. So the answer in that case would be no. However, this Vipassana practice is embedded, classically it's embedded, in a wide array of different Buddhist practices that complement it, support it, go along with it. And so traditionally people would practice a lot of other things together with this particular Vipassana practice. So for example, people would practice ethics, living a virtuous or ethical life, which is considered very important to go along with it. Another complementary practice, which is, has a strong tradition, it's a long tradition, it's a very important part of the wider practices that we practice, is called reflective practices, where you would take a particular theme and then reflect on it. And so you take loving kindness, you can take death, you could take your mother, you know, you could take, you know, whatever. And there's different ways then of practicing with that. One way is to start by doing some kind of practice, that any kind of practice, Vipassana or concentration practice, that helps get the mind very, very quiet, very concentrated and still. And in that stillness, take the thing that you want to reflect on, like this concept, and just say it in your mind, oh, loving kindness or death. And then see how that, it's like dropping a pebble in a pond, and it ripples out, and you see how the ripples go. You see what the ripples are in your psyche from having said that word, just what arises. And in a very still mind, you might be surprised what comes up. That's one way of doing it. Another way is that when the mind is concentrated, it's often a very creative, can be a very creative mind. And it's a very valuable place to think and reflect about certain themes and come to new understandings about it. It's a very valuable part of life. And sometimes people, so it's a very valuable part of life to do that, and I certainly encourage people to do that as well as mindfulness. But the trick is probably for most people have a strong tendency, if a person has a strong tendency to be reflective and think a lot, which I think a couple of people here have that tendency, probably what you want to do is very careful not to do your reflective practice at the same time and place and as you do your regular Vipassana practice, because of the you develop a bad habit. So maybe the reflective practice can be done maybe going for a walk or sitting quietly in a, you know, on a park bench or something. Is this what you had in mind? And then there's also a whole other series of practices, like practices in loving kindness, which are not really reflecting about it or contemplating it, but actually practicing with the intention and the feelings of loving-kindness, which can be non-discursive also, to some degree. Okay. Yeah?
Have you ever thought about vocation, finding a vocation? I personally am at a point in my life where a couple of years down the road I would like to be doing something different, specifically kind of oriented to social change or... Uh-huh. Giving out to the world.
Beautiful.
And I'm curious as to any sort of practice that would help find the true vocation that would fulfill that. I don't know if you've ever thought about that.
So is there some kind of way of finding one's true vocation? Some practices that are supportive of that? It's a beautiful thing, I think, for someone to feel they have some inner calling or sense of, I don't know what, inner calling to a particular vocation. And the word vocation is beautiful because I think it implies much more than just a means of livelihood, like a job. Some people's vocation might not make them any money at all, but it's their vocation to do something. There's, I guess he's probably made a lot of money by now, but like Andy Goldsworthy, I don't know if he started doing that because I think he had a vocation to make this art. And luckily, he apparently got supported by it because Stanford University paid for him to come here and do his wall at Stanford, which I saw last week. So some people find a vocation and end up living lives of poverty, but they're just so happy because they found what they want to do. The thing about vocation is that one of the things I've noticed is that there's a little bit dangerous, this idea of finding one's true calling or true thing that one is supposed to be doing, like the right job. Why it's a little bit dangerous is that for some people will find it, and it's really great to find something they really feel at home in. And some people will never find it because maybe there is nothing, and it isn't that their life then is second best or like they've lost something. It might be what their vocation is not what they do, but how they do what they do. It doesn't really matter what they do. It just matter really has most to do with how they do the particular activity that they're in. They might end up kind of doing something like, I don't know what, but it doesn't really matter what. I mean, some very simple work. Maybe they work as a clerk at Safeway. And they're really happy doing that because what they're doing is not so important as how they do it. How they are with the customers, how they are with, you know, with their activity. So this morning, I was, you know, I make breakfast every morning for my family. I get up a little bit before everyone else and do this breakfast thing. And mostly I enjoy doing it, and sometimes it feels a little bit like drudgery again, breakfast. I'm doing this breakfast thing. This morning I kind of felt this real inspiration, a little bit more than usual, to see if I can, you know, have beauty as part of breakfast. And so I wanted to, not just simply making breakfast, but the idea of making a beautiful breakfast. And I didn't do a lot, but I looked around, and there happened to be a single flower in a little vase in the windowsill. And so I put that in the center of the breakfast table. And that kind of changed the whole feeling of breakfast table. You know, so I don't know if that's the best example, but so for some people, it's how they are. And in a sense, in Buddhism, Buddhist practice stresses most how we are more than what we do, what we are. So how are we in the world? Are we kind? Are we awakened? Are we attentive? Are we, you know, how are we in the world? And for some people, that's really the baseline of what really inspires their life. That's where the practice life is all about, is how we are, in a sense. But that doesn't answer your question. You know, how do you find a vocation if you feel like you'd like to have one? I don't think I have any, you know, good ideas for you, maybe not good ideas, but what I've seen a lot of people do is they go on retreat. They do somehow where they step outside of the normal currents of their life, outside of the normal activities of their life. And they go, so they're really outside of that. Let everything settle away, all their usual thoughts and concerns and habits of mind and preoccupations. And really spend some time doing that, whether it's a 10-day retreat or longer period of time. And then once they've kind of managed to kind of settle away all the everyday kind of concerns and preoccupations and fears and worries and all that, and have gotten some deep calm and settledness, and then to begin sensing or feeling your way into, what is it I want to do in life? Kind of listen, then kind of a very deep listening after you've done that initial kind of preparation. And sometimes I've seen people kind of out of that period of being on the equivalent of a retreat, hear something, some calling, and you know, it could be some time in the wilderness. It could be sometimes just going on vacation, you know, going someplace. Sometimes it can be, when I was at Tassajara, there were people who would come to the monastery there during the summer, or for the winter also, would come to Tassajara for 2, 3, 4 weeks at a time, or longer for a time, in order to do that kind of reflection. For me, I had, you know, couple of things come to mind in my own life. When I was 18, I went off to college. And probably I wasn't prepared for college. Sometimes I think it's better for people not to go to college right after high school, but to maybe spend a year kind of doing something else. My uncle wanted to send me to Australia to go to outback Australia and try to make me into a man. Well. But I went to college for 2 years, and I was happy enough. And I was interested in various things and studying, but I felt I didn't have a passion for anything, and I didn't feel like I should be studying the last 2 years, getting a degree in something, until I had a real passion for something. Not just being simply interested wasn't good enough, so I dropped out of college, which I don't know how it is these days to drop out of college. But back then it was easy because it was that time of. You were supposed to. So I dropped out of college and went around hitchhiking around the countries and stayed on communes and did different things. And 2 years later, I felt I had a passion for something, and I went back. And then the whole quality of my studies was very different because I was really kind of on fire about something, really interested and really focused. So spending those 2 years kind of wandering around, kind of letting something arise. And then the next time kind of that comes to mind now was I was at Tassajara, which is a Zen monastery down there in Carmel. And I felt like I had to make a decision after having been there for a little while about what to do with my life. I had been accepted to go to graduate school at UC Berkeley. And I'd put them off saying, that some personal matter had come up and I couldn't come right then. And the personal matter was that I felt compelled to go to the monastery. But I didn't tell them that. So they said, oh, it's fine. So we'll delay your acceptance for a year. So I had a year to kind of think about what to do. I was at Tassajara. I spent a lot of time there reflecting on my motivations for why I wanted to do something with my life. What I most wanted to do was to be of service in some way, to respond to suffering in the world. And I was either going to go to graduate school in a way that was going to deal with that issue in a particular field that I was interested in, or I was going to, somehow devote myself to Buddhist practice and try to respond to suffering in the world through Buddhist practice, like become a Zen monk and live a monastic life somehow. The thing was that I didn't trust, maybe in anybody, but in myself, the motivation to be of service to others. I didn't trust that that would be pure, that that would be self-serving or egotistical some way. It's all about me and myself and mine, and becoming the kindest person on the block so people would like me or whatever. And so I didn't trust it. So I spent a year at Tassajara, almost a year. Reflecting on my motivation to follow this particular course in my life. It's a long time in one's life to reflect on that particular calling. I guess vocation means calling, right? Vocation, voce in Italian, means voice, or to call out. I don't know. And I decided at the end of the year that at least in theory it was possible to do it purely. I didn't mean that I was pure yet, but in theory it could be. I felt some confidence and some faith in that possibility, and that it was. I felt that it was okay for me to kind of follow that direction. But I still was undecided about whether to go back to graduate school and do kind of a worldly approach to responding to the world, or stay in this kind of more spiritual world and respond. So then I was still kind of, what should I do? What should I do? And the way that Tassajara works was that we would have monastic schedule 4 days of the week. They had a different week than our week. It's really great, to be in some place we have a different week. I mean, the weeks we think of, like, that's the way nature is made, right? To have 7-day weeks. And they don't have a 7-day week at Tassajara. They have a 5-day week. So imagine that. And imagine trying to live in a five-day week. So, and yeah, the weekend isn't 2 days, but it's 1 day. It's every day that has a four and a nine in it. No, is it four 9 days. Number four or nine in it is a day off. So, I was anguished during the days off. The monastic time was really easy for me. But when I didn't have the structure of the monastery and had this time off, then all my thoughts would come back, and I couldn't wait for the days off to be over. because you know, when I was off, I would have to be with myself, oddly enough. So, but anyway, so I was wondering what to do. And then one summer day, the abbot, who was very seldom there, came to visit. And we had the opportunity to have an interview with him, if you asked for it. And so that was a catalyst for me to go sit in a kind of chair overlooking the Tassajara Creek. Very beautiful place, the creek and the oak trees and stuff, whatever. And I was just sitting there, and in some way, very intently, I think somewhat effortlessly, even though I was very intent and very engaged, kind of was catalyzed to really engage in this question really deeply or very seriously, kind of focus on this kind of one point, what I was going to do with myself, which direction to go. And then, as it's happened a few times in my life, these important decisions happened this way. I was sitting there looking at the river, thinking intently, and suddenly the answer arose from within, like from my body. It just kind of rose. And I knew what I was supposed to do. And then I had the reasons. I came up with the reasons why that should be. And then it was clear what the reason should be. But the reason was, I didn't have a reason first. I had this transformation inside. But my understanding was I couldn't have had that transformation inside unless I was also intently engaged in looking for the reason. So, you know, so the two work together. So the reason, thinking about whys, wasn't in itself directly going to provide the solution. But I had to be engaged and at the same time allowing for something else to arise within. But if I'm trying to make something arise from within, that's not going to work either. Does it make some sense? Probably not anymore. So for me, then it was really clear that my vocation was to try to serve the world through the vehicle of Buddhist practice. And so that's what I've been doing for the last 21 years. That's interesting. Okay, please. Well, I was going to ask, this is a very interesting topic. If someone else has something interesting to say about vocation, how to find it. Yeah.
Getting back to the beginning of your talk, it seems like the process so far has just led me to concluding that what I most want to do is absolutely nothing. You know, and I mean, it's sort of hard to say that because, you know, I don't say that at work. That's not usually well received by management. So it's kind of, you know, it's sort of a scary process. It's kind of like, for me, there's a lot of judgment that comes up around, you know, my ideal day would be sleep till 10, get up and meditate, go out and eat, go see a movie, come home and meditate, go to bed. You know, it's like, I don't know if that serves the world, but it doesn't feel like there's anything that conflicts with inner motivation, or, you know, I don't feel like that. Nothing in that scheme that I just described feels like I'm trying to be something that I don't really want to be, or I don't feel any natural inclination to be.
I hope you have a chance to do that for a while and see what happens. Take a month vacation from work or leave absence and do that. See what happens. Yes?
As on top of the note, there's a wealth of support from this community, and there's a number of people who, kind of by accident, cracked their necks and said there's a lot of doubt and mobility in this group. I'd like to not more expand their horizons. But there's a number of people who had very, very good jobs and left to become monks and nuns in Asia in this group. And there's other people who, I know people I remember down to Zen Center, Los Angeles, the person was an engineer and so transformed by the practice and his interaction with his children that he took early retirement and started to become a child psychologist as working with the campus. And there's a lot of examples in this community, so I encourage you to get to know people and to talk to them about that.
And the other thing I think I would encourage anyone exploring this to look at very carefully is to look at your fear and try to find some way so your fear doesn't get in the way of you exploring this deeply. And I think a lot of people have the inertia of fear or worry. I have to kind of stay, you know, keep what I'm doing so that things are held together, or just otherwise I won't, you know, things won't work out. And so, please don't let your fear get in the way. Yes?
I have a very strong calling that came on me slowly just by following things that I was interested in and letting go of what it would be. So I would really encourage you to explore where the sparks are for you and try those things on. And follow, just sort of let yourself go. Don't try to drive to, oh, I've got to do this and it's got to be accomplished this way. So it took me a year or two just sort of following the things that interested me and where the sparks were to arrive at that sort of strong, solid vocation that's carried me for years now.
Beautiful. That reminds me of hopefully, seems okay to say this, but just following what you said, is that when I did go off to college when I was 18, my father gave me this really great advice, which of course I didn't use, but I thought it was really wise advice. He said, when you get to college, go find yourself a park bench somewhere on the campus and just sit there. Just sit there and don't do anything until you find that you're interested in something. And then go in the library and look it up. I thought that was a very nice approach. So wait for the spark, and then see, you know, follow that. So thank you very much. It's lovely to come down here and sit here this morning with you all and be here. And so I'm just very grateful. I feel very happy to be here, and I just wanted to express my happiness and gratitude. So thank you.